Thank you, Brother Keith, and good evening, my dear brothers and sisters and my dear young people. Well, I guess we have to say, don't we, that our subject tonight is one of the great issues of our age. It poses, without doubt, one of the largest and greatest challenges that the truth faces in our time. Because never before in the history of the earth has music been so accessible as it is today. In the car, in the shopping centre, in people's recreation time, at work, wherever we turn, we are surrounded by music. The invention, first of all, of the Walkman and then of the iPod has made everyday music, personalised music, ubiquitous. Because when we think about it, throughout history, if somebody wanted music, they had to gather together the people who had the skills and the experience and the instruments to be able to make music. It was time-consuming. It was expensive. It required great skill. But nowadays, advances in technology mean that music for us is simply the push of a button or the turn of a dial. So tonight, as we look at the subject of music, and particularly we're going to concentrate on music for relaxation, we need to do so in the context of the fact that our ears are assailed with music to an extent that nobody else that has ever lived on the earth ever had to face. Music, as we know, is exceedingly powerful. And therefore, whatever its effect, whether good or bad, it will be felt most strongly by our current generation, more than by any other in the history of the world. Now, let's start tonight by laying one basic foundation. These are words that are very familiar to us, aren't they? And now, Israel, what doth Yahweh thy God require of thee but to fear Yahweh thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him and to serve Yahweh thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul? It tells us that the truth is all-encompassing, all our heart, all our might, all our soul. And it means that there's not a single facet of life which is not lived within the gambit of those principles. The truth applies to all of our lives. So we don't live the truth as if it's in two separate compartments, the part which we keep for the truth and the part which is kept for the rest of our daily existence. Because every nook and cranny of our life, every aspect of it should be filled with those basic principles within the ambit of a vow to God. Whether gardening or tramping, in our hobbies or working, sleeping or awake, everything we do should be within the ambit of those basic principles of life. It should all be capable of fitting within that particular framework. We have a life that belongs to God in all its facets. And that then becomes an effective benchmark against which we can test everything that we do in life, not just music, but everything that we turn our mind and our attention to. And tonight, God willing, what we hope to do is to consider music in that particular context. And when we think about it, music can never be irrelevant as far as the truth is concerned. Because those principles that we see before us there are all-encompassing for every aspect of life. Now, this evening's presentation was originally prepared a number of years ago as part of an evening series we did at a Bible school in New Zealand on music. And we had the opportunity to look at a number of subjects, music and worship. The subject we're looking at tonight particularly is music for relaxation. Of necessity, we're going to be somewhat restricted in how much we can consider in the brief time that we've got available this evening. It's easy to see how the idea of music for worship fits within those principles that we see before us on the screen. But what about other music? What about music in our life that's not directly related to worship? Music of relaxation, of happiness, music of meditation. How does that sort of music fit into the life of the saints? Is it good? Is it bad? Are there different types of non-worship music? Are some types good and some types bad? And tonight, that's what we want to really assess, to look at this particular subject. And we need to understand right up front that this issue is an issue of immense importance today because it's a debate that rages amongst our young people in virtually every country where the truth is found, particularly those that have ready access to instant music. This is a subject that confronts brothers and sisters at every turn, and it's a subject also that challenges the frontiers of parental responsibility. It is, without exaggeration, one of the great challenges of our age. So tonight we want to address the subject from three angles. First of all, let's look at biblical use of music. Secondly, let's look at the world of science and research. And thirdly, let's make some observations based on people's observation and experience. So if we put aside for a moment the subject of worship, music for worship, let's look at other types of music. Are there any examples in Scripture of music being used for anything other than worship purposes? And the answer is yes. In 1 Samuel 16, verse 16, and these are just some examples, music was used to help soothe mental conditions. We're familiar with it. It's David playing the harp or playing the musical instruments before Saul. In Daniel chapter 6 and verse 18, there's a reference to musical instruments there in a context which shows that they were sometimes used to induce sleep. In Luke 15, in the parable of the prodigal son, we find that music was used to express happiness, to rejoice over the return of the prodigal son. In 2 Kings chapter 3, in the story of Elisha, actually, we find that it was also used to induce a state of mind suitable for prophecy. So we look at the example of non-worship music in Scripture. We find it's used to relax, to reduce stress, because of pleasure in the harmony, to express happiness, to help people to sleep, or to heal. And it's notable that all the things listed there are actually beneficial, aren't they, in their effect. They're positive in their objective. And that establishes for us one very basic point, and that is music can be used for good. We also find music used, as referred to in Ecclesiastes 2 verse 8, in a way which was simply an expression of vanity and vexation of spirit. Let's have a look at Ecclesiastes 2 verse 8. We're familiar with the section. It's the wise man writing about the fact that he turned his attention to all sorts of things to try and establish a state of happiness and pleasure. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. I made me great works, I planted me houses, built vineyards, and so forth. And then in verse 8, I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. I get me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men as musical instruments, and that of all sorts. And we can imagine the extraordinary music which graced the court of Solomon. In verse 11, I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. So the approach which he took to music did not bring a beneficial outcome. In Amos chapter 6, verse 1 to 5, we find that music and food are used together in the context of basically people who are at ease, gratifying their every whim, gratifying lust. In Daniel 3 and Revelation 18, we find that music is used very deliberately for purposes of false worship. In Lamentations chapter 3 and verse 63, music and song is particularly used to ridicule. So what do we find? We find that music can be used for good and music can be used for evil. And we need to make sure that we understand those basic simple facts. Music can be used for good and music can be used for evil. Now, why do we want to state this so bluntly? Well, the reason for it is because we actually want to kill stone dead the suggestion that music is irrelevant as far as the truth is concerned, and that music has no spiritual impact on my life in the truth. We've probably all heard somebody claim that there's no correlation between the music I listen to in my relaxation and our life in the truth. And we need to be instantly on the alert if we hear people suggesting that music is irrelevant from the Bible's point of view and has nothing to do with the truth. It's just something that I listen to in my spare time. The Bible's very clear. That's absolute nonsense. Music can be used for good and music can be used for evil, for good effect or bad effect. Now let's spend a little bit of time looking at the subject from the point of view of science, and we basically want to establish five very simple facts. The first one is that music has a physical effect on the body. You know, it astounds me how much debate we hear sometimes on the subject. You know, music affects you physically. Oh, no, it doesn't. That's rubbish. Yes, it does. It has this physical effect on your body. No, it doesn't. That's garbage. Music doesn't affect me physically. Well, let's be clear. In a sense, music is nothing but physical in its effect on the body. Just consider how music is received by the human body. We have there a diagram of the ear, and we see the way in which the ear itself is faced like a trumpet, is shaped like a trumpet, and it's designed to capture sound waves and channel them into a certain point. When the sound is made, it sets up vibrations in the air, doesn't it? We know those as sound waves. Those sound waves gather, they travel through the ear, and they reach the ear where they gathered and they funnel down to a certain point, which is the eardrum. These physical vibrations then set up a corresponding vibration in the eardrum, and that causes three small bones to vibrate. That entire part of the process is physical. Scientifically, the fact is inescapable. Music has a physical impact on the body. At that point, the physical vibrations are changed, they're conducted to nerve cells or the neurons, and the impulses are converted from being physical vibrations to electrical ones. And those electrical impulses then are transmitted from nerve cell to nerve cell along a path to the brain, and the dendrites connect between the cells, and the electrical impulses are then passed along the nerve cells as far as the brain. The brain receives those messages and it's stimulated by them. And all information which is received by the brain is received in that way, via tiny electrical impulses through those nerve endings. And the brain processes these and it responds accordingly. It might be learning. It might issue commands which regulate the rest of the body. It might put things into memory. It might impact upon mood, upon behavior, reactions, and emotion. And all music, regardless of its type, is received in the same physical way. So every piece of music that we hear has a physical impact upon our body. The second basic point we want to make is that actually the whole body receives sound. It's very interesting, you know, but it's not just the ears that actually hear. The effect of the sound waves is also received by the whole body. The whole body is actually a receptor for sound waves and music, including particularly actually skin and bones. I'll give you a couple of examples. One of them is Beethoven. Now, Beethoven, for much of his composing life, was profoundly deaf. Yet, despite his handicap, he was able to compose rather beautiful pieces. Now, when Beethoven composed, sitting at his piano, how could he do so when he couldn't hear? Well, firstly, actually, people who are gifted musically actually have the ability to compose whole symphonies in their head. And they can actually, as it were, hear it playing. In fact, they've been able to measure in the brain what happens. And the brain is stimulated in exactly the same way when a gifted musician imagines music as when they actually play it. But further than that, Beethoven actually chopped the legs off his piano. And he put it on the floor. And he sat cross-legged on the floor so that he could feel the vibrations of the music. And at times, he would actually lay his head upon the flat top of the piano. So that as he heard the physical or felt the physical vibrations, he could hear the music. Because the physical effect of the sound waves were conducted through his body into his brain. Second example is a personal one. Actually, when I was a young child, we had a brother in our ecclesia, Brother Percy Tingey, who was profoundly deaf. And his hearing canals didn't work at all. Now, he had a hearing aid, which was actually plugged in and attached to the back of his skull. And it would actually transmit via his skull. into his cochlea, and from there into the various parts that fed through to his brain. So all music has a physical effect upon us, upon our ears and upon our whole bodies, and it's transmitted from there to have an effect upon our brains. Our third basic point, of course, relates to the power of music itself. The structure of the music itself has an effect upon us in its own right. So when we talk about music and its effects today, we're not just talking about the words, or as they're often described today, the lyrics of the music. The actual sound and structure of the notes, the form and shape of the music itself, is exceedingly powerful in its effect upon us. The brain is made up of many parts. No doubt you've heard of the left and right hemispheres of the brain. Well, they're part of the frontal area of the brain itself. But the brain is made up of many different parts. And different parts of the brain are affected by music in different ways. In fact, one of the things I've found, because I've done a lot more research over the last few weeks, one of the things I've found fascinating is the complexity of the way in which the brain does process music. It's far too simplistic to say, well, this bit goes to the emotional bit and works from there. It's a very, very complex interaction between music and all the different parts of the brain which it triggers off. The words themselves and the mental processing of the words uses very different parts of the brain from the receipt and the processing of the form of the music itself. That's why, for example, someone who has suffered a stroke, which is a blocked blood vessel in the brain which then damages the brain, may be physically fine, but unable to speak. Or may be able to speak, but paralyzed on one side of their body. And so we find that the brain works in different ways, processing different things. Another example, actually, my father, Brother Brian, was the CEO of the Stroke Foundation in New Zealand for a good number of years, and he met a man who was incapable of speaking. He had suffered a stroke. But he could communicate in song. Fascinating. He had lost the power to speak, but he could still communicate in song. It just shows us that different parts of the brain work in different ways. Now, we know, of course, that the structure and sound of music conveys different messages or impressions to us, because if we're putting on, for example, a play, and we want to have a particular scene with a lot of pathos and sadness in it, and we want to put some musical accompaniment to it, we wouldn't grab hold of one of Strauss's waltzes. We select a piece of music and we tailor our selection to get a piece which is complementary to the thoughts or the impressions that we're wanting to create. And we know the way in which the media uses very powerfully the concept of music to enhance its message. And all composers of music are aware of this. So they use notes, sequences of music, which are tailor-made to complement their objective. They support, enhance, help convey the objectives of the person that's controlling it. So when we're assessing a piece of music, never make the mistake of just assessing the words. Also assess the form and the structure of the sound of the music itself. What we find is that songwriters are not dumb. They match the words and the music styles together. Our fourth point is one on the subject of rhythm. The whole human body is actually full of natural movement. The electrical impulses themselves move in a rhythmical fashion. The speed of the transmission of the impulses along nerve endings. The beat of the heart is one of the dominant rhythms of the human body. The reaction times of the brain, the wave patterns and speed of the wave patterns of the brain. The pulse, which is actually different from the heartbeat. The speed of breathing when relaxed, even the pace of walking. In fact, even individual cells vibrate in their own regular frequency. It's interesting to note that the speed of those movements is regular. You know, you can change them. We know that if we walk briskly, our heart rate increases. But in a state of rest, the body's rhythms are actually regular in their pace and the way in which they operate. You can put it another way, the body is absolutely full of natural, regular rhythm. Music also has a rhythm. So when the body hears a rhythm, there's a matching process which takes place, isn't there? The body's rhythm and the music of the rhythm itself, the rhythm of the music itself, are matched off. They relate to each other. I mean, why is it that when you hear a really bouncy piece of music, your foot starts to tap, or your fingers start to drum along, or the body starts to sway in relation to the music itself? Scientifically, what is it that actually makes us respond to the music like that? And it's simply the correlation between the rhythm or the beat of the music and the rhythm of the natural body. It's not a mysterious theory, it's just a basic scientific fact. The fifth point we want to establish is one on the subject of tension and release. You know, sometimes we look at music as if it's an art form, very mysterious in its beauty. But it's also very scientific or mathematical. It uses very deliberate structures and techniques. And one of those is the subject of tensions and release. Because music is actually a series of tensions which are then released, or sometimes you see the word used, resolved. So music is a sequence of tensions followed by resolution or release. The music flows along, something's introduced to create tension, and then it's released as the music resumes its normal course. It's a very common musical technique, and it's one of the things that provides the interest for all of us in music that we listen to. The exception to that actually is in some forms of New Age music, and if you listen to them, it's just a river of sound with no increases and releases in terms of tension and release. Now, a number of different techniques are used to introduce tension and then release. Intervallic tensions, which are simply the sheer rise and fall of the notes. Tonal tensions, which is the use of discordant and concordant notes. We sometimes, in layman's terms, say that music clashes. We have time tensions, variations in rhythm and timing. Volume tensions, with a variation in volume. And timbre and texture, variation between different instruments. And these techniques are simply used very deliberately in the construction of music to involve the audiences in the pieces being played. There's just nothing mysterious about this. It's a technique that's used by all great composers as well as modern ones. So what are our five basic facts? Number one, music interacts physically with our body. Number two, music affects the whole body, not just the ear. The music itself has an impact, not just the lyrics. Music interacts with the body's natural rhythms, and music makes use of techniques such as tension and release. Now note that we're being very careful to avoid all moral issues at this point in time. The question for us now is, well, do different types of music have a different type of effect? Do different sorts of music have a different physical effect upon our body? Is there such a thing as good music physically and bad music, as beneficial and harmful music? And the answer is emphatically yes. Let's consider, first of all, the beneficial impacts of music. We've looked at the ways in which musical sounds can set up physical vibrations, which result in electronic or electrical impulses rather being transmitted via nerve endings to different parts of the brain. Well, of course, different types of music have different effects, and they complement the functioning of the brain in different ways. Music can be used for healing purposes. Now, that should come as no surprise to us as Bible readers because of the incident of David calming Saul when he was suffering mental problems. Music is used very often today to help people in healing. It's used to help people overcome trauma. It's used to help people cope with pain, to help people overcome addictions and psychological difficulties. I spoke to a woman called Christine Archer, who was from the Music Therapy Society back at home, and it was interesting talking to her, listening to the various ways in which music is used to help people in the healing process. Just give one example, music and the concept of coping with pain. Think about the logic of it. The body moves in cycles. Therefore, pain also moves in cycles. If you thump your thumb with a hammer, does it throb? Ever heard the expression, throbbing pain? Well, music also has a rhythm. And if you can help somebody in terms of matching off the cycles of those rhythms, it actually can help people cope with chronic pain. The same techniques used actually when teaching people how to use breathing and the rhythm of breathing to help cope with pain. But the use of music for these purposes is associated with the music's effect upon the brain and the brain's effect upon different organs and parts of the body. They've also discovered that certain types of music actually enhance the performance of the brain, the actual functioning of the brain, and therefore the mental functioning of the person. Why were ancient myths put to music? Why are psalms designed to be sung? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? If you put some words to music and learn it as a song, it greatly enhances the retention of the words. Words set to music stick in the mind. That's understood by advertisers, isn't it? It's used very powerfully as a technique on television and radio. Secondly, they've also discovered that certain types of music actually help people with reasoning processes, cognitive reasoning. You may have heard of the phrase the Mozart effect. It was actually the result of some research done a number of years ago, and it actually almost achieved pop status for a while, and this idea was if you play music, you become smarter. And as a result, the scientific community has moved away from it a little bit. I've got a very interesting article. I'm not sure if I've got it here, or I've certainly got it on the computer, where someone's gone through and they've actually looked at all the different research that's done on this particular area. And there is no doubt, it's very well established, that certain types of structure of music, and Mozart is often used as an example, or Baroque music in general, certain types of music actually do help reasoning, cognitive reasoning processes of the brain. There is debate about how long the effect actually lasts. There are many organisations. I spoke to some people in an American organisation called the Super Learning Inc., and they particularly use Baroque music to enhance the learning processes of children. So music can certainly enhance the functioning of the brain, learning, memory, and health. But unfortunately, the reverse is also true. Some forms of music are immensely destructive. Now, logic makes that obvious, doesn't it? If the structure of some types of music helps the working processes of the brain, it's able to affect the interaction of the nerve endings and the impulses they send through in a beneficial way, then you'd have to suspect that it's possible to structure music in a way which is not so helpful, that might be damaging or destructive. I have at home a very interesting article written by a man called Greg Mackay entitled How Music Affects Your Kids, What Parents Need to Know. The article is actually very good. It's quite comprehensive and it's rather alarming. Greg Mackay points out that on the basis of a lot of scientific research that's been done, how modern rock music in particular is extremely destructive for those who listen to it. Ignoring any moral considerations at all, he explains how rock music affects the brain, how it deadens the intellectual processes and retards learning and thought processing. His article itself is quite compelling reading, but I wasn't prepared to accept his words on face value. Who is this guy? Where does he come from? Is he a crackpot? Is he credible? Does the scientific research he refers to actually exist? So I tracked him down. He lives in Montana, but I actually located him in Washington, and I rang him up at the hotel that he was staying in and talked to him about the subject. It turns out that Mr. Mackay is a lecturer who travels around the states lecturing on music and its effects, its beneficial and its harmful effects. He does a lot of talkback radio interviews and shows on this particular subject. I found him very interesting to talk to, and he put me in the direction of some very interesting information. One of the leads he gave me was actually to a high school student by the name of David Merrill, who was 17 at the time. This is a few years ago now. And he had just completed a research project to see if they at that school could reproduce the effects of some of the research that others had done, to see if they could prove or disprove claims about the harm of listening to different types of music. So I found out where David lives. He lives in Virginia, so I rang him up and I asked him to tell me all about his experiment. You see, I didn't just want anecdotal evidence. I didn't just want secondhand rumour. This issue is so serious that I wanted to hear it, as it were, from the horse's mouth. I wanted the facts. I'm going to share with you what David told me about their experiments. They selected 72 mice. These were white laboratory mice, and they were bred for science purposes. All of them were of the same age. He ensured that they were fed and given water in exactly the same proportions, and they had the same light conditions. He took those 72 and he broke them down into three separate groups. One group had Mozart music played to them. Another group had rock music played to them. Actually, it was a heavy metal band, Anthrax. Great name, isn't it? The third group had no music. He kept it as a control group. Now, first of all, the mice were all given 1 week to settle into their new accommodation. They were then all run through a maze and timed. It was a standard research maze and had a food reward at the end. And it took an average of 10 minutes for these mice to find their way through the maze and find the food. There was no difference between any of these three separate groups. The groups were then subjected to music 10 hours a day at 70 decibels. Now, lest you think that that's too heavy, it's loud, but it's no louder than the music that young people listen to on iPods. It's certainly no louder than the typical heavy metal music that's played, and it's lower than the level at which hearing loss starts to take place. At the end of the week, each of the mice were run through the maze 3 times. The time results were then recorded. After 4 weeks, the control group had learnt the process, and they'd reduced the time from 10 minutes to approximately 5. The Mozart group went through the maze in a range of between 1.5 and 2 minutes. The anthrax group took between 26 and 30 minutes to navigate the maze. Now, those results are rather stunning. Does it perhaps suggest something to you? Well, it certainly told David something, and it was very interesting to listen to his comments about the experiment and their horror at the results. There's been a lot of interest in his work, and he appeared on the media in the States quite a bit as a result. There was a lot of interest in his work. In actual fact, there's nothing new about the experiment he did. He was simply repeating different form of experiments which have been done by many different people. Mr. Mackay's article also referred to a published science paper, an experiment that was done by Dr. Harvey Bird and Dr. Gervasia Schreckenberg. So I found out where those scientists work, and I rang the Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey where the experiments were carried out. I found that actually the two scientists concerned no longer worked there. The research had been done a number of years earlier. However, they were able to confirm for me that the research had been done, that it was genuine, and they had the results of the research on file. They told me that Dr. Harvey Bird was a physicist who specialises in magnetic and physical waves. Actually, his particular area of expertise was on the effects of magnetic fields created by the Earth's crust and planets and so forth. But as a sideline, he became interested in the physical effects of sound waves. And he teamed up with Dr. Gervasia Schreckenberg, who was a neurobiologist, someone who studies the workings of the brain. And together they conducted this research on the impacts of music. Now, I was subsequently able to locate Dr. Bird's daughter, a lady by the name of Mrs. Colleen Messina, who lives in Montana. I wasn't able to speak to Dr. Bird because at the time I was trying to contact him, he had just been involved in a very severe car accident. For 3 weeks he'd been in intensive care. However, his daughter was able to supply me with copies of their published science paper. I've got a copy of it here if anyone's interested in having a look at it. It was published in the Bulletin of New Jersey Academic Science in the fall of 1987. It's entitled Neural Plasticity of Musculus in Response to Disharmonic Sound. It takes some reading. It's interesting, they actually also took a number of mice and they exposed the mice to two different forms of music. They had harmonic sound and disharmonic sound. Now, when we say disharmonic sound, what they were referring to was essentially what we would describe today as syncopation, where there's an offbeat or an irregular beat in the music which they were subjected to. And they had exactly the same result. The disharmonic music had a significant impact on the effect of those particular mice which had been subjected to it. They also went through a maize process. It's very interesting. I'll read some extracts shortly from that. However, in this particular case, there was a difference, because Dr. Gervasia Schreckenberg was a neurobiologist. So when the experiment was complete, they, nice word, sacrificed the mice. They dissected them. And they actually physically analysed the brain structures of these mice. They looked at the neuron structures of the mice as well. And in this paper, they've actually drawn pictures of the neurons of these particular mice. And they show what physically happens in the brains of these particular mice. And what they showed was that the neuron structures of the brain were obviously and visibly damaged. The basic point that comes from that is that music which is disharmonic or strongly syncopated, works on the offbeat rather than the main beat, actually clashes with the body's normal rhythms and creates stress. The stress is reflected in brain damage, it inhibits learning and the ability to retain memory. In case we miss the point, rock music is brain damaging. And you can't refute it. Rock music is brain damaging. Now, this is going to take a bit of reading. I'll read it slowly. In this study, prolonged exposure to acoustical dissonance and its negative influence on the rhythmic nature of nerve tissue, physiologically active nerve tissue, is postulated to cause physical damage to brain components with subsequent behavioural alterations. In particular, electrical stimulation of the hippocampus, which is part of the brain, by abnormal sound patterns in the course of learning may alter information registration. It may disturb the hippocampal theta rhythm that is associated with the inscribing of an experience onto neuronal structure and which is considered to be an optimum state for memory storage. The group that listened to the disharmonic music showed a definite a definite increase in the time spent finding the food reward. In general, the mice exposed to excessive disharmonic sound were not highly efficient at finding the reward after latency and spent much of their testing time either at a standstill or exploring aimlessly, often repeating their search in the non-reward area of the maze. The male and female mice of the D group, however, were noted to be more aggressive, hyperactive, and disinterested in food during post-latent testing than the animals from the other two groups. He makes the comment, it's not surprising that many pathological alterations could also occur in neurological structures. In the case of brain cells, this disordering can manifest itself not only in the physical state of the neurons, but also in the harmony of their functioning as well. Consequently, the behaviour of the organism may become seriously affected. Now, if anyone's still reluctant to accept this point, I've got several references to other works, and I also have copies of more recent papers and more recent work which has been done. It just confirms the same thing, simply becomes increasingly compelling. The journal Perceptual and Motor Skills referred in 1993 to research which was done on the preference for rock music and its impact on mathematical reasoning abilities for young adults. The same journal actually in 2003, and I have a copy of it here somewhere. It's in the pile somewhere here. The same journal in 2003 showed that actually one of the things that staggered them was that the effect was long-lasting. That actually where it had a harmful effect on mental processing and the way in which the brain worked, that it was actually lasting in its effect on those that were subjected to certain sounds. By the way, that experiment was done with humans, not with mice. We also found records of experiments that were done looking at rock music and muscle strength. It's been repeated over and over again. So the simple point, brothers and sisters and young people, is that modern rock music itself is damaging. It deadens the brain, it damages the intellect. The more extreme the forms of rock music, hard rock, punk rock, heavy metal, and so forth, the more extreme the forms of music, the worse the damage that occurs. Now, really, observation itself makes it obvious, doesn't it? Have you ever watched a person wired for sound listening to something like heavy metal? The twitching shoulders? The drooping head? The mouth that protrudes? Seriously, you watch. Glazed eyes and that delightful thing called headbanging. I mean, we've seen it, haven't we? And you've just got to watch it, and you've got to say, well, you know, it doesn't take Einstein to realise that this is not a gigantic intellectual process which is being undertaken here by this person. By the way, there's one aspect of David Merrill's experiment which I didn't tell you. They had to do the experiment twice. The first time was a failure because they made a basic mistake. They housed each of the three groups together. And after 3 weeks, when I say together, in their three different groups, after 3 weeks, there was one heavy metal mouse left. They tore each other to pieces. So they had to repeat the experiment and house them individually so they could actually complete their work. David's words to me, his exact words were, with an American accent, it was kind of scary. Well, I find it kind of scary too. I hope you do. It's rather frightening to contemplate, isn't it? In fact, actually, Harvey Bird's work also illustrated the same thing, increased aggression on the part of music of mice that were subjected to that sort of music. Well, let's consider another aspect. We mentioned before this idea of tension and release, achieved in a number of ways, by volume, by different types of sound, different types of instrument, changing the timing and the tone and so forth. This, again, we said, matches the natural rhythm of the body. For example, breathing. You think of the way in which you breathe in, creates tension. Breathe out. Release. There's nothing magic about this in any particular way. It's a well-known technique used by modern composers, by all composers. But one of the interesting things about much modern music is that with a lot of modern music, the technique is actually turned on its head. So rather than from time to time introducing tension and then following it with a release, we find that the music actually creates tension through things like offbeat, syncopation, the matching of harmonic and disharmonic notes, but with no corresponding release. Again, this is not witch doctor stuff. It's a simple technical analysis of the structure of the music. This is a textbook on music. It's not about pop music, simply a textbook on music itself. And it says, in a square 4 beats to the bar sequence, a simple syncopation or an occasional 2-beat bar can create a strong tension effect, which is resolved by reversion to the normal rhythm. If every bar and every part is syncopated, we soon begin to lose any real sense of tension, and there only remains a sense of ill-defined unrest. And the net effect on the human body is a continuing state of hype, of bodily tension and intensity. We've just got to look at it and say, surely that's not beneficial for the human frame or the human mind. Let's think about the concept of a very dominant beat. It's probably the most obvious feature, isn't it, of modern music, the use of a very strong and dominant rhythmic beat. There was a researcher at the ANU Research School of Social Sciences in Canberra who has some very interesting comments about this particular feature of modern music. A researcher from the ANU Research School of Social Sciences in Australia named D.W. Skubik has some very interesting things to say about this. Skubik has found that measurable responses in the body's muscular system, brainwave patterns, and hormone levels are produced by rhythms where drum beats are prominent or provide the basic beat. Skubik found that in response to the tempo of the beat and the loudness of the music, the brain goes into a state of stress. This causes the brain to try and re-establish a balance and prepare the body for pain by releasing its natural opiates. These opiates are brain chemicals similar to the drug morphine, and the brain releases them to raise the pain threshold and to counteract potential depression. This action by the brain can become addictive over time because, as Skubic says, one soon needs to have opioids released to feel good. An example of this they use is jogger's high. A particularly rapid and dominant beat in music stimulates the release by the body of natural drugs, endorphins, cortisol, and others. In fact, it's really interesting. I've actually found a lot more science papers since then. I've got examples of some of them here where that's actually been measured. They do blood tests. They can physically quantify the increase of these drugs that are released into the body itself, the effect of a heavy beat in different styles of music. What's really interesting is to see the way in which sometimes it's linked in with the idea of increased pleasure, and sometimes it's linked in with the idea of stress and what they call fear and flight, or flight and fight. Again, when we look at it, we think about it, this is not crackpot stuff. This is just basic scientific fact. It's interesting talking to a brother in our ecclesia at home, Brother Brendan Clark, about it. He used to work in the field of rehabilitation of people with drug dependencies, and it's interesting listening to his description of how the body actually can affect itself with these particular natural drugs. Now, we're going to have a listen to a few examples of music, and I want us to listen to these thinking about what we've considered so far this evening. Don't need to say anything, do I? You know, when we listen to rock music, it's not because we don't know. It's because we choose to. It's the same reason why African natives use a drum beat to try and enhance the inducement of a trance state for voodoo ceremonies. It's the same reason that Pentecostal ceremonies use loud, beaty, rhythmic music as part of their ceremonies. Skubic actually goes on to be rather more specific about the body's release of certain hormones through the same process and explains why the growth of immorality in the world has been synonymous with the pop industry since its inception. I'm not going to go into any more details. It's not edifying. The message is clear. Brothers and sisters and young people, have you ever wondered why there is such a close connection between immorality and promiscuity, drug abuse, and all forms of modern pop music? It's the effect of the music, and it's the content of the words, and the two match. It shouldn't be a surprise. Come back to the point we made at the outset. All composers ensure that the songs, with their words, match the structure of the music, that the words of the songs and the music that they apply them to actually match. It's as simple as ABC. Now let's keep ignoring for a moment, if we can, all the moral implications and consider only the physical impact of the sound. We've got music that deadens the brain, the intellect, and it stimulates a bodily need for an easy feel-good time. It's hardly conducive to life in the truth. There are two very interesting books which I read in my preparation originally for this subject. One is by Professor William Kilpatrick, who was a professor of education at Boston College. His book was entitled Why Johnny Can't Tell Right from Wrong. The other was by Professor Alan Bloom, who was a professor at Chicago University. Professor Bloom has taught at Yale University, University of Toronto, University of Tel Aviv, and the University of Paris. His book's entitled The Closing of the American Mind. Now, neither of those two books is about music. They're actually simply focusing on modern society and the issues in modern society in relation to the education of today's youth, particularly the sense of values and the open-mindedness or otherwise of modern youth. But both of them dedicate a whole chapter to the subject of music in their particular books. Both books were quite controversial. They were met with howls of outrage by the music industry. But they are two eminent educationalists who dared to describe what they observed as being the effect of modern society and what was happening in the education sector and to youth in America. And they point out that modern rock music and the whole pop culture is enormous business. Did you know that the pop music industry is actually bigger than the entire movie industry globally? It's enormous business. They also point out that the pop industry, both in its lyrics and its sounds, are targeted at certain particular thoughts and ideas. They point out that the music is designed for easy access to a feel-good feeling, to emotion. It's deliberately structured for a feel-good sort of experience. And they show that it's actually very different to reasoned emotion. That music emotion that's released by those heavy beats, the emotion that's released is actually very different from the emotion which comes from a reasoned intellectual comprehension of something. And they point out the enormous grip that the pop music has got on young people. In America, the average teenager listens to something like 10,500 hours of pop music between the 7th and 12th grades. Another study, a more recent study, found that the average teenager in America listens to something like 40 hours of music per week. And they track through the development of the pop music culture and show how it's always been a vehicle for youth through its time to reject the social values of the day, to reach for some inner feeling of good or well-being, and also to grapple with issues that are important to youth. And they point out that young people are particularly vulnerable, particularly susceptible to manipulation by the commercial pop industry in that particular way. The subjects and the music are deliberately targeted to exploit the vulnerability of young people because it's good for sales. They're basically sucked in by commercial exploitation. And they show with some very graphic and very vile examples how, as the music scene has deteriorated over the last 10 to 20 years, these messages are actually starting to become more explicit. Professor Bloom says, it is of historic proportions that a society's best young and their energy should be so occupied. People of future civilizations will wonder at this and find it as incomprehensible as we do the caste system, witch burning, harems, cannibalism, and gladiatorial combats. It may well be that a society's greatest madness seems normal to itself. Well, a future society, a future civilization will look back and wonder about the madness of the society in which we live. In our own society, however, says Professor Kilpatrick, we seem to have managed to create an attachment to all the wrong things, or more precisely, parents and teachers have by default allowed the entertainment industry to create these attachments. Rock music in particular, says Bloom, inclines children away from self-control and sublimation. It doesn't channel emotions, it pumps them up. Instead of a passionate attachment to what is good, noble, and just, youth develop passionate attachments to their own needs, wants, and feelings, to people like Mick Jagger and Michael Jackson. On the essence of pop music, he says, it is never in love with a particular object or person, but only with those feelings which that person or object evokes. You know, that's very, very astute. The sentiment which is expressed in those songs is never actually on the basis of love with a particular object or person, but with the feelings which that person evokes. Consequently, it is fickle. It's always changing its object of devotion. It's always in search of a new high. By necessity, its interest is in novelty rather than stability. Think about the impact of that, for example, on attitudes towards marriage or anything stable in life. I don't doubt the sincerity of the feeling in listeners who respond to the We Are the World, which is the theme song of the Live Aid concert, but I question whether those are the sort of feelings that can translate into committed and sustained action. Rock music allows us to indulge in expressions of strong emotion while freeing us from the obligation of doing anything. So why are these men concerned? Well, they're concerned because they see the effect, they see the process and its effect on America's youth. And I want you to look at that particular transparency, that particular overhead, and analyse it for a moment. What do we see? Do we see there a progression over the course of time? All we have listed there is about 70 years of Western society. See the progression from folk songs to classic music to jazz blues. When I say 70 years, that's basically from the time of jazz onwards. Jazz, blues, country and Western, rock and roll, hard rock, punk rock, heavy metal, and rap, or hip-hop. For those who don't know what rap is, it's merely the latest development over the last few years. It's the next logical extension. It's simply a stream of vile expletives, a stream of profanities, murder, rape, incest, anti-police, violent racism. It's just poured forth in a stream of sewage to the accompaniment of a basic primal beat. It's hate, it's violence and anger. But when we look at that progression, you notice an accelerating pace of change, an accelerating pace of decay. And you just look at the way in which that music has changed increasingly rapidly over the last few decades. Why is this happening? Well, Professor Kilpatrick says, talking about a chap called Leyland, he's more than a little concerned about all the adolescent rage that runs through hard rock and rap rock music. This surprise and shock puts me in mind of C.S. Lewis's comment about people who laugh at honour and are then shocked to find traitors in their midst. He goes on to say simply that this kind of lyrics is always implicit in the music itself. If unrestrained emotion is to be king, there should be no complaining about violent emotions. What's he saying there? He simply says that if you cast off moral constraint, you shouldn't be surprised at the consequences and the outcomes. We're not going to have time to go through all the material we've got here this evening. It's actually quite interesting. There was an article in the National Geographic magazine just a few years ago. I don't know if you get the National Geographic and whether you've seen that particular chart. It actually tracks through the development of the history of music through to rock, hip-hop at the end, rock and roll, rhythm and blues and so forth. And it's the development of music over the last 100 years. And what it shows, actually, is its African roots and the way in which African music has come through and changed, completely changed, Western music. There are specific reasons for that, by the way. I've got a very interesting article here by Richard Waterman. And he just simply technically shows this difference in structures between African music and European music. He shows that European music is based primarily around harmony, complex harmony, and very simple rhythm. But African music is based around very simple harmony, but particularly complex rhythm. In actual fact, it's a very interesting article. He shows that it's very clever music, and that it actually works on multiple meters. In other words, different timing. So you could have a 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, and a 1-2-1-2-1-2, and a 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, and all of those simultaneously running through the same piece. That's actually where strong syncopation comes from. And they just track through the way in which the heavy emphasis on beat, because actually African music is predominantly beat with harmony across the top, as opposed to European music, which is predominantly harmony with beat simply just an incidental part. Think through, for example, the role that drums have in an orchestra. They're not sitting there going ka-dunk, 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 ka-dunk for the entire concerto, are they? They're just used from time to time for effect. You know, sometimes there's concern expressed about guitars being used in Christadelphian hymn singing. We have concerns about that at home when you see it happen. Why? Well, the guitar is not used today for its harmony or to play the melody. Listen, this is a generalization, but it's true probably for 95% of the time it's used, maybe 99. Listen to the way it's used. The guitar is actually used as a percussion instrument. It's used as a stringed drum. Dum, 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 dum. And it's basically a change that's taken place in music that we experience today. And it's very interesting to see simply where its roots have come from and the way in which music has changed. Then we stop and we think for a moment about the pop scene, and we think about everything that goes with it. Hysterical youngsters screaming their adoration for their hero, their idol. Does it sort of match with honouring God? Drug use, immortalised by people like the Beatles and Strawberry Fields and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, LSD. Don't need to say much more, do you? You look at rock carnivals, Woodstock and so forth. What images do those words conjure up in your mind? Look at the lives and the stated aims of the rock stars and look at everything they stand for. You know, if we objectively analyse it, you couldn't select an element of society which is more at variance with the principles of Christ. Holiness, sobriety, faithfulness, and diligence. But despite discussion, brothers and sisters, this problem is actually becoming worse amongst the brotherhood, amongst our young people, and not better. Why is that? Why is it that actually pop music and rock music is becoming more entrenched amongst our young people rather than the reverse? Well, one of the things I found very interesting about Dr. Bird was that he raised major concerns in his paper and identified areas which needed further research. He couldn't find anybody that was prepared to fund the research. It's not a priority in today's society. They don't see the need for it. When I first spoke to Greg Mackay, I told him that I was looking for hard evidence about the dangers of rock music. You know what his response was? Oh, he said, be careful. We never tell anyone that rock music's bad for them. We have all the evidence. We know it's bad for them. But if we ever tell them the facts, they just switch off. We find we can't get away with telling people that rock music is bad. They just don't listen. You know, I find that scary. And I think if we're honest, we have to say there's a risk of that same thing at times amongst our community as well. So let's step back and be very challenging and ask ourselves, well, what is it about the subject that makes people react that way? Why is it that we can reject such a clear message? Issue a challenge to our young people. Why is it that when we hear people talking about the dangers of music, we instantly react with cynicism? Why is it that when we find young brethren that I've spoken to, young brethren who know that it's bad for them, they just find it really hard to give it up? Well, there are several reasons. One is that the pop music industry has very carefully targeted a particular group of people, young people, and it focuses on issues which they are particularly susceptible to at a time in life when they are not well equipped to deal with them or to see the falsity in the views that are presented in that music. Secondly, it's pleasant to the flesh. When something's pleasant to the flesh, people don't want to change. Flesh rebels against restraint. Thirdly, it's actually addictive. We've seen the reasons why. And reason doesn't do well in the face of blind addiction. You know, if ever a subject called for objective and open-minded analysis, it's this particular subject. One of the things which I had wanted to consider tonight, but we haven't got enough time for it, sadly, is the subject of Christadelphian pop. You know, when I first did this talk a number of years ago, there was no such thing as the Christadelphian pop scene. And in the few years that have intervened between the preparing of this talk and our evening this evening, that situation has dramatically and terribly changed. And I will guarantee that all up and down the length of this country, our Christadelphian young people will be buying and trading in Christadelphian pop music. All the sites are there on the web, and it masquerades as being Christadelphian music. You get the whole range of genres. You get basically stuff which is hard rock through to croony ballads and everything that goes in between. It's really interesting to look at the way in which the excuse gets put forward that this is good for introducing our young people to the truth and helps them relate to the truth in their particular age. It's the same reason which has always been used through time to introduce compromise. It's music which is featuring very strong syncopation and very strong beat. It is music which is completely unsuited to the idea of worship for all the reasons that we've looked at tonight. In fact, the author of this book makes the comment, one question that logically arises here is whether rock can be reformed. Some think it can be, that by simply it's a matter of changing the lyrics or attaching the music to a proper cause. You know, I've debated this subject with some young brethren, so you know what they do? They take the words of Scripture, authorized version, in fact, and they stick that in their music, word for word out of the Scriptures, and they say, see, fine, the lyrics are beautiful, and the music is not. And we need to awake to the fact that this is actually being peddled amongst our young people. The internet makes the marketplace worldwide. In some parts of the Brotherhood, it's being pushed, it's being sold as fundraisers for various Christadelphian functions and activities. It's a serious, serious issue amongst our young people. And it doesn't matter what country I've visited, this issue is terribly alive. And it's something we need to be very aware of, and we need to understand what's happening amongst our young people. I've actually gone through, and I haven't got time to go through it tonight, but just gone through and analysed the use of various modern pop techniques in some of this music. It's not just the syncopation, it's not just the beat. It's actually the form of the words. There's a particular style of what I would call pseudo-singing that goes with pop music. I've got another piece of music, we won't play it tonight, but it's actually a well-known singer in the UK, a chap by the name of Russell Watson, and he's singing a particular piece. And it's really remarkable to see how he changes his style mid-verse, as it were. And it just makes it very obvious there's a very different style of singing used in pop music today that's being introduced in all this Christadelphian pop music. Why? It's a simple take from the world. I can't see how anybody can believe that there is no association of that type of music with the pop industry generally. But I've talked to young brethren who are pushing this stuff, and they've said, oh, no, it's not the pop industry for me. It's got nothing to do with that. This is just the sort of music I like. I've got a really interesting piece of research here. You know, you cannot disassociate music from its context. You cannot take pop music and put Christadelphian words to it and assume that it won't have a link with the whole pop culture that goes with it. You just cannot do that. This particular research was about wine sales in a supermarket. When they played French wine, French music, recognisably French music, they found that the sales of French wine went up. When they play German music, they find, recognisably German music, that the sales of German wine go up. And when they ask the shoppers at the end whether they heard the music, they say no. You can't disassociate forms of music from association and ideas in our minds. Parents. Look at these words here. What we currently have is censorship by omission. Either parents don't know about or don't have a taste for alternative forms of music because they were themselves raised on rock, or they do know but are afraid to exercise their parental rights for fear their children's allegiance has already been captured, and to stand up to the music would only widen the rift. What results is a pattern of denial. Avoid noticing what the words say. Assume the kid will get over it. Professor Bloom, the child I described has parents who have sacrificed to provide him with a good life, who have a great stake in his future happiness. They cannot believe that the musical vocation will contribute very much to that happiness, but there's nothing they can do about it. The family's spiritual void has left the field open to rock music. They cannot possibly forbid their children to listen to it. It is everywhere. All children listen to it. Forbidding it would simply cause them to lose their children's affection and obedience, better to set the faculty of denial in motion. The result is nothing less than parents' loss of control over their children's moral education at a time when no one else is seriously concerned with it. Parents, where do we stand? Have we considered this subject as far as our own children are concerned? Are we aware of what our children are listening to? Have we sat down and gone through the words of those songs with our children? Try a good technique. Sit down and write the words out that you hear being portrayed. Analyze them. Do they fit in as words that the Lord Jesus Christ would speak or that Paul would recommend? Or do we simply turn a blind eye or a deaf ear? Do we put it into the too hard basket? So, brothers and sisters and young people, well, what should we do? The first thing is we actually have to recognize that the issue is here. It's real and it's alive. It's a deadly evil that we all face. The second thing we need to do is to get rid of that influence in our lives. And what that means, young people, is you take the CDs and you smash them with a hammer. You don't put them in the bottom drawer. You completely smash them. You deliberately take the CD and you smash it so it's gone. And then you pray. You pray earnestly for the Father's help, because breaking a habit or an addiction is not easy. Understand that there will be times in life when you are very sorry for having done that to the CDs. But be strong. Don't waver. Because you know the issues, you know what is right, and you know that God will always be with the man or woman who diligently asks his help and tries to do what's right. And then replace it. Replace what you've lost with something better. It's actually a taste that you will learn. It may take time. It may take effort. Don't be surprised if you don't enjoy Bach's organ fugues instantly or a particularly complex piece of classical music. There's actually an enormous range of classical music available. Again, it's not something we've got time to go through tonight, but there are all sorts of different forms of classical music to develop a taste for it. And just be assured, you're only going down a path that's been trodden by many others before you. And the most important key here, actually, is the fact that no amount of logic, no amount of evidence, no amount of persuasion is of any use unless you actually have the will and strength to make a personal decision to do something about it yourself. Because, you know, being frank, every shred of scientific evidence we've looked at tonight was completely and utterly irrelevant. Because basic biblical common sense would have given us the same answer in 15 seconds. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things.